Welcome back to this second portion of today's seminar entitled Grieving with Grace. As we continue this, I wanted to start to give you some other considerations in terms of things you can discuss or treatment approaches that you can use with your clients as they're going through grief, mourning, and loss issues. The next tool I think can be helpful with many of our clients is this poem. It's called My Old Friend Grief, and you can actually follow along with all this stuff in your PowerPoints that are also on that website, on our River of Life Professional Counseling website at www.rolpc.org. So if you want to look at any of these poems or things later, or actually get, you know, the typewritten out version of those if you're doing your audios as a home study, feel free to follow along with the PowerPoint. So this poem is by Adolfo Cadaza. My old friend Grief is back. He comes to visit me once in a while just to remind me that I'm still a broken person. Surely there's been much healing, but the truth is we can never completely heal. We never adjust to the loss of a major love. We'll be all right, but we'll never be the same. And so my old friend Grief drops in to say hello. Sometimes he enters through the door of my memory. Sometimes he sneaks up on me. I'll hear a certain sound, smell a certain fragrance, or look at a certain picture. And I'll remember how it used to be. Sometimes it brings a smile to my face. Sometimes a scar. Some say that such remembering is not healthy, that we ought not to dwell on thoughts that make us sad. Yet the opposite is true. Grief revisited is grief acknowledged, and grief confronted is grief resolved. My old friend Grief doesn't get in the way of living. He just wants to drop by and chat sometimes. In fact, grief has taught me over the years that if I try to deny the reality of a major loss in my life, I end up having to deny life altogether. He has taught me that although the pain of loss is great, I must confront it and experience it fully, or else risk emotional paralysis. Old Grief has taught me that I can survive even great losses, and although my world is very different after a major loss, it is still my world, and life is worth living. He has taught me that when I am willing to be pruned by the losses that come, I can flourish again in season, not in spite of loss, but because of it. My old friend Grief has taught me that the loss of a loved one does not mean the loss of love. For love is stronger than separation and longer than the permanence of death. I thought that was a really, really neat poem, My Old Friend Grief. It kind of puts in perspective the elements of grief. Many of our clients find it difficult, and many of us, for that matter, find it difficult to talk about mourning and loss. Sometimes if we personify something like grief, depression, anxiety, anger, it makes it easier for us to deal with it. Some of my clients are good with drawing or journaling, and so sometimes they'll actually draw out something that looks like grief, whatever they would consider that for them. Sometimes it might be a character that looks a certain way. Sometimes they'll just tell me a narrative about if grief was a person or a monster or a critter or some kind of force, what it would be like. Some, they just write about the actions or attributes they feel grief causes. But I find that for many of our clients, it becomes easier to talk about when we use the metaphors about grief. This hits on, for a lot of our clients, that search of making sense of things, or as I said earlier, that phrase, meaning-making. So what exactly is this term, meaning-making? We're talking about evaluating the meanings we've already made, but it's more than that. We're also talking about how do we create new meanings? How do we transform meanings on different levels? The meanings of things in our life can be defined by the purposes that they promote or achieve, the social interactions with others, or what is useful in a given developmental state. So when we're helping clients work through this whole thing of meaning making, we may be helping them develop short-term and long-term goals. Again, things are easier to achieve if we're talking in concrete behavioral terms. I often use with my clients this idea of a camera check. Meaning, if there was an imaginary video camera there, what would it see happening if I felt that life was going more the way I hoped it to go? What would be happening if I wasn't struggling so hard? What would be happening if I didn't have to deal with this trigger or stressor? What will be happening when I'm less depressed or less anxious or I feel more like myself again? The idea behind meaning making is that suffering actually helps us to redefine ourselves. It can be growth producing and enhancing. One of the things I frequently tell clients is that I wish I could promise them that they wouldn't have more stresses in life, but that unfortunately, resiliency is only achieved by having some kind of stress. It would be nice to know that, oh, such and such won't happen again, or there won't be another unpleasant surprise around the next bend. But the fact is, the only way we know we have some of the skills we have today to get through things is because we survived something. So we actually can put a bit of a positive spin on it. Now, you may not feel like a survivor, but there's skills that have been developed. There's ways our clients have managed in spite of feeling like they're not doing a great job managing. And some people not only survive, but even thrive and do better and move on to great things. There's a lot of literature, for example, surrounding people who've gone through trauma, especially people who've survived domestic violence, that once they really just finally have enough and they decide to get out from under that oppression, that there's a level at which they live that's so much more optimistic in terms of that thriving than you would have ever thought was possible. There's a new optimism and hope and forward movement about someone taking charge to develop their own identity. With meaning making, after someone's gone through that struggle to try and understand, oftentimes as they move to the other side of the morning, they're better able to appreciate the beauty in life. One of the exercises as some of my clients go through the mourning process, eventually, after we've spent some time doing the early work and over time move towards more of the reintegration and what we want the next chapters of life to be, one of the things that they can start doing, which is really neat to watch, is to appreciate the beauty in each day, to find optimism, but especially things like gratitude. It is really hard to do that, especially early in the mourning process. I mean, it feels like there's nothing to be thankful for. It feels like the pain, the struggles, the sadness, depression, the stresses, it just feels like a big spiral. But basically, through the meaning making, most people report that eventually they find light in what initially felt like darkness. Some people find meaning in faith. There's a prayer for learning that was in the literature by an unknown source. It says, "My wounds may heal, but my scars never fade. Help me embrace them, not despise them. Teach me how to live with my scars, how to tend to them, how to learn from them. Remind me, I have the power to turn my curses into blessings, my shame into pride, my sadness into strength, my pain into compassion." There's many things that meaning making does. One that is very common in the literature is meaning making in the long run helps people develop a sense of faith. So one of six factors in terms of that is spiritual well-being. And overall, I get a better sense of who I am, that I do have a destiny and purpose in life. Things are not haphazard. I'm here for a reason. There's a sense of recovering a meaning and a sense of control. That while when I'm going through mourning and loss, I might not be able to control many, many factors, there are a few things I can control. Another sense is that there's ongoing physical and emotional things, but over time, I learn skills to manage those. There's faith. There's an ability to believe because I start to see some optimism in the midst of pain. For some people, this faith may operate in a sense of community around them, of support people. For some people, it might be religious practices. For other people, it might be more of a general mindfulness. But it also involves a working through of the losses and a redefining of whatever seemed to be an upset or disturbance. There are some behaviors in the literature that have been identified in the research about what is it that helps people when they're going through this wrestling about meaning making. First of all, if they have a sense of, I value life in general, I know that there's something in the midst of the pain. If they have a sense of wanting to live life to the fullest. But the other thing that assists the meaning making is a sense that time is not just endless, you know, that there are phases, there are things throughout my life, and, you know, what do I want to achieve? I don't have every access to everything all the time. I actually have to make choices, and I can take responsibility for some of the choices and options in my life. We can assist our clients in terms of personal growth, of who they want to be, of what their choices and goals are, of lifestyle changes they might want to make, what interactions they want to have, or what boundaries they want to set with family members, with others. I always tell clients, you're responsible for setting boundaries, but you're not responsible for how the people on the receiving end take that. And that's hard, because with grief being such a unique thing, people don't always receive our boundaries well. Behaviors also which assist in meaning making are things like having a social connection, compassion, or a sense of I can move on, with a greater sense of perspective, a sense of acceptance, ability to draw from some of the healthy memories and place them where I want them to be from here. Another thing that the meaning making does for a lot of people is it helps them as much as they're able, which I know is limited, to be able to prepare for death and changes in the future. it helps them really redefine what they consider quality time. Truly, when you've had a loss or a life change of some sort, when there's been mourning, there's always a sense of reevaluation. Wow, what do I want to do to spend my time? What's important to me? Not everything can be equal. I actually draw out with clients a pyramid, and I call it the relationship pyramid. It's a big triangle, and I divide it into sections and talk about how the bottom section at the base of the pyramid is bigger and broader. It's general, it's polite, it's when we interact with other people, there's more people in that category. But towards the top of the pyramid, the section's smaller. And that's the section of the people where we believe we truly have two-way communication, where there's vulnerability, where, you know, we hear from the other person, they hear from them, where there's freedom. So helping define who we want in that inner circle, so to speak, that everybody hasn't achieved in our life the right to be that, that they can't put themselves at that level of closeness necessary. So with meaning making, we find relief from suffering, possible spirituality, our identity, and we process through the emotions. One of the keys, as we've alluded to before, is finding out who our support system really is. Is that a spouse or a significant other, perhaps? A sibling, a parent, a grandparent? But a lot of times people don't always have that in terms of biological relationship or someone they live with. So we may need to help our clients broaden who could that include. Can we, within reason, as a therapist in a therapeutic relationship and alliance, be a support system in terms of skill development as they process through mourning and loss? What about if they're involved in things in the community? If they're on a sports team, for example, or have hobbies or activities, could their teammates or their friends be part of their support system? What about those they go to school with or colleagues they work with on a job? If they're attached to a church congregation, a temple, or if they have a minister, could that be part of a support system? We've also talked about pets. What about a pet? Pets can often be very calming and soothing and help de-escalate. The key, I think, though, is regardless of who our clients defined in terms of support system, we need to empower them about how do they express what they need. I actually have included a list here in the PowerPoints, and I give this to clients in terms of a handout. But I talk with them about it's not enough to just tell people around you, I need help. It's important before you start filling in the details of talking with someone to really start with what do you need. Literally, they've done studies in neuroscience, which is just fascinating, to see that in these studies, different parts of people's brains turn on. If you start a conversation with them by telling them, well, I'm going to tell you about my day, but right now I just need listening. For the next 20 minutes, I just need you to not have distractions with your phone or TV, but I just need you to sit with me on the couch and let me talk and vent. The part of the brain that has to do with listening turns on. They see that in the neuropsych studies. Or, I think I've made a decision about a few things as I move forward in my life. I want to run it by you. And after I share with you kind of what I'm thinking, I would like some advice from your point of view. The part of problem solving turns on. Or I need help prioritizing. I'm feeling pretty overwhelmed by all these tasks and things going on. I need a sense of perspective. I just feel like everything's spinning around me because of the shock and disorganization. So much happened. Can you just help me talk it through? Or, wow, I'm having difficulty completing chores and doing things. Things that seemed to come easy to me before are not. Or sometimes we just need empathy or validation. So it's really important, as silly as it sounds, in order to make the discussions effective between our clients and others about support systems, that they start with what they need. That can include listening, advice, distraction. Sometimes there's a time where you just need someone to say, hey, let's go out. Let's go somewhere. Let's do an activity, you know, that someone won't let you just sit and mull over something. Help scheduling things. Sometimes to be able to delegate something to something can be so freeing when you're already overwhelmed. Relaxation. Again, that being versus doing. Sometimes we can be so oriented towards do more, do more, do more. But to be able to actually have a place that's a refuge and reprieve. Other things we need. Activities, a sense of perspective, spirituality, help with chores. Empathy. Grief is very individualized, as I said. I'm going to read to you a story called A Carrot, an Egg, and a Cup of Coffee. And this is another tool that you can use with clients. Stories and metaphors can be so effective with our clients because, again, sometimes it feels threatening oftentimes to clients to have all that emotion about their own life situation, but to talk in metaphor just feels like another little protective layer there. A young woman went to her mother and told her about life and how things were so hard for her. She didn't know how she was going to make it. She wanted to give up. She was tired of fighting and struggling. It seemed as if one problem was solved, then a new one arose. Her mother took her in the kitchen. She filled 3 pots with water and placed each on a hot fire. Soon the pots came to a boil. In the first, she placed carrots. In the second, she placed eggs. In the last, she placed ground coffee beans. She let them sit still and boil without saying a word. So we have the carrots, the eggs, the beans, the 3 different pots. In about 20 minutes, she turned off the burners. She finished the carrots and placed them in a bowl. She pulled the eggs out and placed them in a bowl. She ladled the coffee out and placed it in a bowl. Turning to her daughter, she said, "Tell me, what do you see?" "Carrots, eggs, and coffee," she replied. Her mother brought her closer and asked her to feel the carrots. She did, and noticed that they were soft. The mother then asked her to take the egg and break it. After pulling off the shell, she observed the hard-boiled egg. Finally, the mother asked the daughter to sip the coffee. The daughter smiled, and she tasted the rich aroma. Her daughter then asked, "Well, what does this mean, Mom?" She explained that each of these objects had faced the same adversity, boiling water. Each reacted differently. The carrot went in strong, hard, and unrelenting. However, after being subjected to the boiling water, it softened and became weak. The egg had been fragile. Its thick outer shell protected the liquid interior. But after sitting in the boiling water, its inside became hard. The ground coffee beans were unique, however. They were in the boiling water, but they changed the water. Are you the carrot that seems strong, but with pain and adversity, do you wilt, become soft, and lose your strength? Are you the egg that starts with a malleable heart, but changes with the heat? Do you have a fluid spirit, but after a death, a breakup, a financial hardship, or another trial, have you become hardened and stiff? Does your shell look the same, but on the inside, you're bitter and tough, with a stiff spirit and a hardened heart? Or do you act like the coffee? The bean changed the hot water. The very circumstances that bring the pain. When the water gets hot, it releases the fragrance and the flavor. If you're like the bean, when things are at their worst, you get better and change the situation around you. When the darkest hour and trials are the greatest, do you elevate yourself to another level? How do you handle adversity? Are you a carrot, an egg, or a coffee bean? I love that story. That is so cool. And I think what's interesting is we're not one at all times. Even within ourselves, sometimes we're like the carrot. Sometimes we're like the egg. Sometimes we're out like the coffee. There's moments you might feel like you actually can change and impact the environment or the people around you. Then there's other times where you just become soft and things seem to affect you. And it's just so hard to move on. Then there's other times where we're just like, I'm so hard. I'm so frustrated, maybe even resentful, bitter, or angry. This is a great metaphor to use with clients because it gives them permission to wrestle between, you know, some of the attributes of each of those things. So in terms of grief counseling, we want to help them with coping, meaning making, giving themselves permission to reflect, allowing the freedom and the timing that works for them about how to move forward, connecting with support systems, dealing with setting assertive boundaries, you know, regardless of what others might think, dealing with their own loss, mortality, and unpredictability of life. So they've surveyed clients who were going through changes, losses, and mourning, and asked them directly, what did you find helpful? So I want to share with you what the client said, because that's most important, more than me theorizing about, oh, if I did this, maybe this will help. What the literature says, that clients said they liked practical cognitive strategies about how to be optimistic, to increase their positive self-talk, to have healthy avoidance when they need to, but proactive actions when they needed to. Many people who considered themselves more spiritual liked the clinician to acknowledge their worldview, their spiritual beliefs. If they were a Bible-believing person, they wanted there to be freedom for Bible verses or prayer to be incorporated into the discussion. If they had other spiritual resources, they wanted freedom for those to be able to be brought up. Of course, we can never rule out Rogers process variables. Clients always highlight that listening and empathy, that positive regard. Let their story be their story and create an environment in the counseling office where there's freedom to hear it. But other things that they need assistance with practical resources. Like I said, one of the areas of counseling where we are going to do a lot of collateral type of work is going to be with working with our clients on practical resources, probably signing release of consents to talk with other people. Again, there may be medical referrals needed for pain, for psych meds, for community assistance, for a lot of other things. We may need help. They may need help with how to express things verbally. This may sound silly, but just because someone's an adult and just because they're pretty intelligent and can express things doesn't mean when life stress comes along that they're going to be great at still expressing things. Like I said, it throws them for a loop. Clients also said physical exercise helped. Balance between getting out and having alone time helped. The freedom to talk about and reintegrate their relationship with the deceased or any factors of things that they're mourning about. They also said what was helpful was assistance with decision making, providing information and facts, options or referrals, anxiety reduction techniques, strengths-based approaches. I find that fascinating because a lot of times, again, when we're in the moment, clients come to us with presenting concerns. They want to feel less depressed. They want to feel less anxious. They're tired of feeling stuck. So what our clients are telling us is when we help them use that language of you've managed change before, we're communicating to them through using strengths-based, solution-focused approaches that we believe that there's skills they have that they could use some more. There's things that they've done, maybe not this exact situation or circumstance, that they can work through. The other thing clients said has been helpful is thought restructuring. Remember, a lot of times with depression, anxiety, stress, that they're automatic negative thoughts coming in. So helping them do thought stopping and reconsider, and then helping set behavioral goals. Now I want to make a shift here to something I alluded to a few times so far in today's seminar, and that's the narrative approach. The literature says we are born into stories, the stories of our parents, our families, and our culture. There's power in telling our story. There's a social worker, Brené Brown, that a lot of us in the field may have heard of. And she talks about kind of how the sting of shame and other things, trauma, different things that are challenging to deal with, kind of is removed when we tell a story. The other thing that's really cool about the therapeutic relationship is that we are co-authoring narratives. So we can help clients in terms of narrative approach in terms of several different things. One is by empathizing through their story. We hear the client's meanings and help them with their communication and understanding of if they want to keep those meanings going. I remember I had one client who in her corporate setting was so amped up every time there was a meeting. For her, meeting, that word just sent red flags to her and made her nervous and scared. She was worried. She was self-critical. And her mind went through these automatic negative thoughts of, oh no, what's going to happen next? It's going to be bad. I'll lose my job. They won't like me. They'll see how fragile I am. So helping hear associations and create new ones. We also hear clients agonizing. We focus accentuating. We help focus the client's attention on important features of experiences that they might overlook. We do something called nuancing. We highlight and pass aspects of their story back to the client to further elaborate, to understand. Another thing we do, the literature calls dilating, widening, weaving, overlaying, or connecting strands of related material. So basically, we're looking for themes. Constricting. Sometimes our clients may be all over the map, and we're like, whoa, you know, you can kind of feel what they're feeling, this flood of stuff. Sometimes we may help to narrow them and say, wow, that sounds like a lot of important issues. It's a lot to deal with. Okay, we have 45 minutes in our session. What would be the most important one of those that we could start with as an example? Another thing we do is contrasting. And we help them foster more appropriate meanings. We also want to facilitate clients' self-evaluation about their inner experiences, their behaviors, what things represent for them, what their desires and goals and needs are. Language is a type of performance. Language is something we do together. Again, having the counseling relationship is a co-authoring situation. And it's the way in which we recreate our worlds. Personal losses, such as those our clients are coming into us for, can be mirrored, validated, and honored. Contextual factors and community identification can become less rigid. We can take another person's perspective and adopt new meanings. Here's a couple things I want to highlight in terms of how do we help a client through narrative therapy process pain, emotional pain in general, loss. So first of all, as I can't highlight enough, respect the client's story and respect their conclusions. What are the stories they're telling themselves? What repels them? What are the aspects they want to stay away from? They hate revisiting, thinking of, they make them feel horrible. And what attracts them? What are the things they want to spend more time focusing on? Another thing as we go into this grief therapy with clients is remembering that the inevitability of pain is what it actually takes to bring genuine healing. So we have to be really careful as we co-construct these narratives and being delicate with the timing and sensitive to what a client can take at a given time. We're really responsible, honestly, ethically, for if a client's too amped up, we want to make sure and do little doses. For example, when I do empty chair exercises with clients and give them an opportunity to say figuratively to someone what they'd want to say or work through with that, I end up doing that maybe for the first 10 or 15 minutes of the session, and then I process what some of the reactions, the positive, the acknowledgments that they need to hear so that they're not leaving amped up. We need to remind our clients there's no testimony without a test or a pain. There's no victory without vulnerability. Unfortunately, some of the lessons we've been taught in life, like I said, good people get good things, bad people get bad things, are not necessarily true across the board. That there really isn't a straight line to just perfection and an easy life. Life will prove itself to us, and we need to be careful to avoid those extremes, those all or nothing. So we're, through the narrative, assisting the clients in the telling in the beginning, the history behind it, the middle, and what they want the next part to be. So our role is helping them reconceptualize problem-bound stories, helping them reassemble alternative outcomes, and help them make new alternative endings strong and stronger than the problem ones are coming in with. So the partnering with us can really be helpful. It can give them affirmation, strength, strengthening, and realize that they can move beyond where they're at. It really can highlight that strengths-based solution focus piece. They've even found when we do work with couples that sharing grief stories helps actually build couples' closeness. And if we give couples the tools of empathy, perspective taking, those basic things, it can bring them closer together. We can teach them to avoid some of those horsemen, John Gottman's horsemen, like withholding, not communicating, or silence. We can teach couples how to communicate within a context. This would go for family, systems, significant others, if you're working with any level of group. We can help people work the process across time. Oftentimes, journaling and writing can be helpful. But be clear, we don't want to assign that to a client if we've not given them the skills to process it. So sometimes using these things like the poetry we talked about, the metaphors, things like lessons of courage and fear, so how to restory, and maybe someone who started afraid or concerned or was affected by something in life and how they overcame it. Things like another area that can be helpful to journal about or reflect on is one's sense of identity. That's something that's really shaken up a lot of times when we're talking about grief. Who am I? Who did I think I was? Who did I think other people wanted me to be? Especially when you're hearing those bumper sticker answers from people, it gets to a point where it's like, oh man, you know, who do I want? What if I hold my ground about what's important to me and who I am? Will people love me? Will there be unconditional acceptance? And, you know, it also gives them a chance to look at what they think other people should know about them. Scrapbooking is another type of useful activity. One really strong example that I had in counseling from the past where scrapbooking was just phenomenal and really worked wonders for a client. I had a lady who was a grandmother. She loved her granddaughter. But for whatever reason, my client and her own adult daughter, the mom of the granddaughter, didn't get along well. The mom decided she didn't want the granddaughter to see her anymore. And so the little child, the granddaughter, you know, couldn't speak up, couldn't make that decision for herself. It broke the grandmother's heart. One of the exercises eventually we came to through the counseling process was for the grandmother to do some scrapbooking. This grandchild that she loved was in preschool and was going to approach kindergarten. So she would write in her scrapbook little notes like, it's nice to see you grow, explore the world, I want to encourage you to become the little lady you're supposed to be, and that kind of thing. Then when it would be the time that the granddaughter was starting kindergarten, the grandmother would say, you know, wow, what an interesting year. You're going to make friends. You're going to learn new things. I just want you to know I'm cheering you on. And the fact was, we didn't know if someday the mother of the child, of the granddaughter, would really let her see the grandma again. But regardless if it happened or not, the scrapbook could be a useful tool for the grandmother, for my client. And it was. It was phenomenal. We were able to use it in sessions. And what was really cool was 6 to 9 months into the counseling, eventually that little precious girl, the granddaughter, asked the mom and said, what is the problem you have with grandma anyway? Why can't I see her? And so eventually there was some reconciliation, and basically the granddaughter and grandmother got to see each other, and also just kind of re-highlighting that the mom's tensions with her mother was separate from the issues with the little girl. And so scrapbooking can be useful. It can help our clients choose which memories they want to process with us, things of the past. Especially with photos. Photos are phenomenal because it really tells us what things the clients choose to focus on, to remember. What are the events they choose to freeze in time? It also helps with scrapbooking. What do I want the future stages to be? What's the next story level? And it positions for the client them that the narrative is ongoing. So it can create a door for optimism. As I stated a little bit ago, another technique I use with clients sometimes is the empty chair technique. When there's grief or loss, one of the things many people report is a sense of unfinished business. It could be not resolving a conflict. It could be I never got to achieve what I wanted to at a past workplace. I never got to implement certain things I wanted in my life in a certain setting or a relationship. It could be regrets. It could be wishes. But what's nice is the counseling office can provide that unique, safe setting for our clients to really talk and work through. As I stated before, I think it's really important that we really are time limited, though, in this intervention and generally do it early on in a session. I may explain the idea behind the empty chair to a client one session. Sometimes they're a little bit awkward about doing it or not. If I don't think they're ready for it, you know, that's fine. We don't have to do that approach. We might do something else. But if it's something they're open to and may not be too overwhelming, we might start up with that in the next session. It's been particularly helpful for people when family of origin narratives were stirred up in their life, when issues that they thought they had dealt with but maybe hadn't, maybe traumas of the past got stirred up, or maybe some schemas that seem to repeat themselves keep coming up. The empty chair has been really helpful with that. Now I want to move to another type of technique that in recent times has become something more in the forefront. And this is the issue of using technology to honor our loved one if there's a loss. So now, more than ever, we have cell phones, we have TVs, we have all kinds of apps, we have so much access to different types of technology, which can be a tool. I'm not saying those of us who work in the mental health field are excellent about using technology, but there are variations of this that you could potentially incorporate with therapy. For example, there might be a way of helping a client plan how they want to make use of technology in terms of their rituals of working through a narrative. So, for example, if someone has a loss or a death or they're mourning something, maybe they want to have like a video montage or a picture, whatever, something of a person or a situation that they're remembering. We can encourage that as an option if it would be beneficial to the client. There's two types of programs out there. I've not used them, but I'm just going to mention them if you're interested in looking into them, that are actually out there. One is called Time Card, T-I-M-E-C-A-R-D, Time Card. And the second one's Fenestra, F-E-N-E-S-T-R-A. And so a lot of these things collaborate with photos, memories, videos. They give a digital storyline of a person's life. What's cool is there's options to put photos with dates and to title them. Sometimes for a client, even if they're just bringing their phone in, I've had clients that have said someone, something, a pet, a job, a cause impacted their life. And so they'll show me pictures maybe from their phone even, or bring in photos. And just naming that, titling it, what descriptions they offer, why they captured that certain memory, that really can be healing for them. It's kind of basically like building an altar to that person, what things they want to remember. Some people, even in their home, in their privacy, might want to have, I'm trying to think what this thing is called, almost like a digital photo type of thing that alternates pictures about memories with a person or a situation. There's things like candle holders, picture frames, but you can create things with that. So use of technology. I've known some people, if they have, say, a Facebook or another sort of technology that they use, where there may be memories, there may be like a board where they put up things and people can contribute to their positive memory. I remember when my dad died suddenly a year ago, there were opportunities for people they streamed the services and the things for him, but there were opportunities for people through technology to make comments as they went along while the streaming was going on or later, basically like a digital notebook sort of thing. But in moving on with the narrative, we have to help the client look at what is the type of help they need. So types of things they might need moving on is, can someone accompany me to fill in the blank, whatever that would be, an appointment? Can someone be there with me because I just need an emotional support? What about making phone calls to so-and-so? Is anyone able to help take care of my children or my pets? Can anyone look after my house? What about helping with some chores? Can someone just let me talk and just be there and not solve it for me, but just listen? I need some activities to distract me. I'm not sure what I can do. I need support. And again, any of those different ways we talked about earlier, like listening, empathy, problem solving. It's important to remind our clients that self-care is multidimensional, moving beyond from the mourning process. We're talking about physical self-care, spiritual, emotional, social, and intellectual. One of the handouts I give my clients that I absolutely love, I think it's a really balanced, good narrative, is one called Mourner's Rights. And I've cited the reference in the PowerPoints and in your bibliography from a book from Zamore. I'm going to read some of these to you. And I actually, in some client sessions, will read them aloud to the client, because they don't oftentimes hear these from other people. More often they hear the bumper sticker answers, but not these parts. I have the right to experience my own unique grief in my own unique way. I have the right to feel what I'm feeling, regardless of how this shifts from moment to moment. They have the right to feel angry. So I would use the word you. These say I, so there's things they can tell themselves. But in the session, I would say you, and I would, you know, speak it over their life, because they hear all this, you're that, you should do this from someone else. So I might say, you have the right to have your own unique grief. You have the right to feel what you're feeling, even if it shifts from moment to moment. You have the right to feel angry. You have the right to be treated as a capable person. You have the right to say no. You have the right to privacy. You have the right to ask for help. You have the right to be listened to. You have the right to be treated with respect. You have the right to socialize when ready. And I love that they added that phrase, when ready. Same thing, to do when ready, to be quiet when ready, you know. It's all about timing and readiness. You have the right to cry or not. I like that too, because again, there's not one size fits all. Some people, the tearfulness might be what they need. Other people, it may be other emotions or seemingly no outward emotion, but some other way of processing. I would also add to the client, you have the right to express your feelings. You have the right to be upset. You have the right to be supported. You have the right to express your needs. You have the right to talk about grief. And I love this next one. You have the right to experience joy. I found that that's one of the hardest ones for my clients. I remember one lady during the COVID times, she and her husband were planning for his very soon retirement. He had worked really, really hard and was going to be able to retire young. Well, a series of events happened where he ended up dying, presumably of what they said was side effects of COVID and a lot of respiratory types of issues. It was very sudden. So in that timing, all of a sudden, everything that they were just planning about, they were getting their farm ready, what they were going to do in the long run, what they were going to build on their land, what they were going to do, the adventures, it felt like it went out the window. And I remember she talked about family members, neighbors, coworkers, and people, some with bumper sticker answers. But one day, some coming over and wanting to have ice cream with her, and actually at some point wanting to go to a music concert. And I remember her questioning, am I allowed to go to a concert within so many months of after my husband died? And for her, it was so freeing to hear that you have the right to experience joy, that it is not a direct reflection of your love or lack of love for someone to actually do something that's nurturing for yourself. The other rights that I would say to a client include, you have the right to feel a multitude of emotions or none. You have the right to be tolerant of physical and emotional limits. You have the right to unexpected bursts of grief. You have the right to use healing rituals. You have the right to embrace spirituality. You have the right to have fun. It's okay. You have the right to be disappointed. You have the right to treasure the memories you want to treasure. You have the right to be alone. You have the right to set the times that are meaningful for you about the bereavement process. So there's a term that I found interesting. I hadn't heard before, but in doing my research for the seminar, called mindfulness-based bereavement. I know you may know in general about mindfulness, just being in the here and now. So again, a lot of that is highlighted, but the idea is what they call attunement. They use the acronym ATTEND, ATTEND. So the A stands for attunement, being fully present, decreasing overall avoidance. So just in the here and now. I don't have to solve everything. I don't have to solve a big wave of stuff and know how my life's going to be after this event. So the first T in ATTEND, trust. Compassionate hearing is part of mindfulness-based bereavement. Therapeutic touch. Again, I highlight the part therapeutic. Anything we do should be for the benefit of the client. And there's nothing to say every client needs touch or can benefit from touch. But also, if a client initiates, and if it's done in an ethical, responsible way that's reassuring, therapeutic touch can reinforce empathy. Egalitarianism. This goes back to the collaboration of the restorative narrative with the client and the therapist. And nuanced care. So sensitivity to individual factors, cultural factors. And then D, they call it death education. I think that's a weird phrase. But basically the idea, psychoeducational piece of information. Again, the biggest piece being that death, mourning, loss is not a linear thing. One thing I wanted to touch on, which at first may not seem exactly related to the grieving and mourning, but really I found as a central repetitive issue with many of my clients, is this issue of shame. It seems like when I talk with my clients and they're wrestling with all the emotional factors of grief, that a lot of the shoulds come up. When they're talking about regrets, whether it's about unfinished business or something that client thinks they've done or they think someone else should have done or the sense of unfairness, shoulds come in. Some of those can be, I'm unworthy, what I've done is too bad, forgiveness is too cheap, I didn't pay enough price, or that other person or structure or situation didn't pay enough price. if only the good, right, perfect, nice, moral, ethical things were done, then good things should have happened. Shoulds in general, ideas of I have to do the right things. So we're helping a client move through and out of shame. Let me make sure we're all clear about what I mean when I talk about shame. We all have behaviors we've done that maybe aren't what we hoped they would be. And behaviors can be changed. But there's times where we really are self-critical towards, you know, ourselves in terms of I'm a bad person. I'm not good enough. I fell short. I'm unworthy. This is what I'm talking about with shame. Shame's a subjective emotion. It's linked to our perception of our identity. It's very narrowly focused. Oftentimes for people, it becomes part of a habit and can make us feel kind of paralyzed in moving forward. That's why dealing with shame can be really important in terms of the mourning, loss, and grieving with grace. We don't want someone to get stuck in paralysis. There's this perception of inadequacy. There's this belief that inside, I'm inherently flawed. I'm imperfect. It's impossible for someone to love me. I'm defective. Life's not going to go good for me. Yeah, maybe for someone else out there, but it's never going to happen for me. So there's this sense of negative, global, stable, and uncontrollable erroneous outcomes about ourselves, about others around us, and about the world in general. There's this fear of disrepute. There's this sense of I better cover up my humanity. So there's this unstable trust and security because there's this disappointment in oneself. Shame-based relationships tend to have a common foundation of control and chaos. There's a sense of mystery surrounding them. Like, how did we get here? There's a sense of just giving up and being resigned to, well, guess I've fallen short. I'm so bad. Why even try? There's resentment. The rules aren't clear. So that's why it's so important people like Brené Brown talk about verbalizing the narrative. We can't work on stuff if we don't say it, if we don't bring it to out in the open. So that's why what we do, the work we do in psychotherapy is so important, because we're bringing things to the surface. We're giving permission and a safe context for clients to do that. So they're moving beyond feeling cursed, feeling controlled, feeling like there's lack of forgiveness. They just have to react to situations. They're ashamed and they're trying so desperately hard to get others to like them and approve of them. We're helping them move beyond that. We're helping them move beyond them feeling trapped, reminded of their inadequacies, exposed, defensive, and overly responsible for things that have a lot more factors than just our client alone. I use another narrative that I've cited in the literature here called the parable of the prisoner in the dark cave. There was once a man who was sentenced to die. He was blindfolded and put in a pitch black cave. The cave was 100 yards by 100 yards. He was told there was a way out of the cave, and if he could find it, he was a free man. After a rock was secured at the entrance to the cave, the prisoner was allowed to take the blindfold off and roam freely in the darkness. He was to be fed only bread and water for the first 30 days and nothing thereafter. The bread and water were lowered from a small hole in the roof at the south end of the cave. The ceiling was about 18 feet high. The opening was about 1 foot in diameter. The prisoner could see a far light up above, but no light came into the cave. As the prisoner roamed and crawled around the cave, he bumped into rocks. Some were rather large. He thought if he could build a mound of rocks and dirt that was high enough, he could reach the opening and enlarge it and crawl through and escape. Since he was 5'9", his reach was maybe another couple feet. The mound had to be at least 10 feet high. So the prisoner spent all his waking hours building rocks, digging up dirt. At the end of 2 weeks, he built a mound of about 6 feet. He thought if he could duplicate it again, he could make it before the food ran out. But he had already used most of the rocks in the cave. He felt he had to dig harder and harder. He had to do the digging with his bare hands. After a month passed, the mound was 9.5 feet high. He thought he could almost reach the opening if he jumped. He was so exhausted and extremely weak. One day, just as he thought he could reach the opening, he fell. He was simply too weak to get up. In 2 days, he died. His captors came to get his body. They rolled away the huge rock that covered the entrance. As light covered and flooded into the cave, it illuminated an opening in the wall that was 3 feet wide. It was the opening to a tunnel to the other side of the mountain. This was the passage to freedom the prisoner was told about. It was in the south wall, directly under the opening of the ceiling. All the prisoner would have to do was crawl about 200 feet. He would have found freedom. He was so focused on a light that it never occurred to him to look for freedom in the darkness. Liberation was there all the time, right next to him, right next to the mound he was building, but it was in the darkness. Remember what I said earlier about resiliency? I always tell my clients, I can't necessarily promise you won't have stresses in life, but sometimes the only way to build those resiliency skills are by going through those stresses. And sometimes it's in the darkness that there's a light, but we just need to change a perspective or to work on developing the new narrative. So when we talk about the concept of fear, shame builds fear. Fear can be perceived as forget everything and run, which breeds avoidance. And we definitely see that with some of our clients. It's just so overwhelming. And sometimes it's even self-protective that there's avoidance. Then we have the alternative for fear, face everything and rise. It's possible, and we want to instill in our clients. It may not feel like it. I wouldn't say this to them right when they're coming in at the beginning. But as they come to some realizations, as we co-author the narrative with them, it's possible that they might feel a little more alive again. Maybe never in the same way as before. It's not about what's happened, but the idea that life can be different. It's all about what they're feeding on, what they're focusing on. There's a quote I've included in our PowerPoints here. If you eat all other people's emotional garbage, which could be those bumper sticker answers, like I said, it becomes your emotional garbage. But if you do not take it personally, you're immune, even in the middle of hell. Another reference that I put in the literature, before we make deep changes in our lives, we have to look into our diet, our way of consuming. We have to live in such a way we stop consuming things that poison and intoxicate us. Then we'll have the strength to be the best, to arise, no longer be victims of anger and frustration. In order to move beyond shame, we need to learn to take nothing personally. People just grieve differently. It's not necessarily when people give those bumper sticker answers and things that they're right, that we're wrong. But as people learn as we can work with our clients on how to test out through the cognitive debating skills, the automatic negative assumptions. They can learn to have freedom. They can learn to consider a variety of options and explanations for things. They can learn to remove that guard from their heart. I heard someone say once, if you're going to put up a wall, at least have a window or door. They can also test out, is what I'm doing really working? If I continue this, where will I be in a month, 6 months, a year? One thing that often comes to the surface when we're dealing with our clients, especially with grief, is that sometimes there's some pretty strong and not always healthy family of origin messages. And I've listed in your PowerPoint some of the ones that are most toxic that I hear repeatedly from clients. Things like be good, right, strong, and perfect. Things like shut up and don't speak. Things like don't rock the boat, don't share your opinions. Be numb, be careful, be blind to expectations. What matters is other people, not you. Be in control of all your behavior. Think in terms of those if-then thoughts. Deny your feelings, especially if they're unpleasant. Don't try to figure out or do any meaning-making. Just expect that things will be unreliable. Don't think, don't feel. Now, I wanted again to go back to this idea of bumper sticker answers. I actually have a list here. And these are things, again, that clients oftentimes will say have really complicated their grief process. So example of types of things that they have heard from people, again, who mean well, but just say things that are not at all helpful. You'll be okay. It'll get better in time. God's grace is sufficient. Yeah, you won't have more than you can handle. Just do such and such and things will be better. I always think it's funny when people say just whatever because they make it sound so overly simplistic. Or people might say, oh, I know how you feel. They might have things like, oh, you just need to get on with your life. When there's a death, sometimes people have bumper stickers like, oh, you have an angel in heaven. Or don't do such and such. Don't cry. Don't be angry. Don't think at all of yourself. That's selfish. Another one, the bumper sticker answers, it isn't so bad. Oh, it could have been worse. At least you knew it was coming. You should be over it by now. You're strong. You'll get past this. Hang on. Let go. Get back to the normal life. We want to make sure that we as therapists are cultivating empathic responses. And if you have an opportunity to work with couples, with families or systems about anything that could be perceived by any person as a loss, it's really important to teach empathy. We need to not assume that just because someone's an adult that they know, understand, or can practice empathy. We may need to explain the difference between sympathy and empathy. That we're not just talking about feeling for someone else, feeling sorry for them, but trying to identify what they're really going through and then expressing and summarizing it in a way the other person can affirm that, yeah, you got it. So I use the idea of what I call the communication game. There's three key components I try to help people understand when they're hearing someone's experience of grief and loss. The first part is you feel blank. We're just trying to hear as the other person experiences it. Not a judgment, not should they feel that or should they not feel that. not if it makes sense to you, not if you think they're crying too much or not enough, not if they're angry, not if they should be this or that, but just hearing it. Oh, so do you feel such and such? Yeah. Then the other person can say, yes, that's exactly what I feel. Or, no, not quite that. I actually feel blah, blah, blah. Again, it may not be the way you experience it, but it's giving that person freedom to experience it as they do. Second part, after that first person understands the feeling, is to understand the situation as our client sees it. Oh, you feel that because to you, you saw it this way. I incorporate that idea of the camera check. If there was an imaginary video camera there, what would they see? What behaviors are they attuning to? Oh, you feel just caught off guard because you never imagined that this kind of horrific stress could happen to you in your life. You never thought that your young child could die. You never thought that as hard as you were working, that you were going to be the one to lose your job quickly. You never thought that as much as you cared, that that person would betray you and you'd lose a friend. So we want to, again, hear, yeah, you got it. It's not empathy if you're just saying, okay, I understand you. Saying you understand doesn't mean you understand. It's important to summarize it in a way that that person who's going through the grief really feels you do. So how they feel, why they feel that, and what they would like in the future is the third part. So summarizing, oh, so what you would like to happen is, so for example, you could use more help around the house. You're so worn out from all of this and you need extra help. Yeah, I really could use someone. Oh, you would like someone just to listen and not judge and not tell you what you should do. Yeah. So the key with offering empathy to the person going through grief is allowing for freedom for that person to tell his or her story as he sees it. Again, not with judgments, not with words like right or wrong, or this is a success or a failure, or you're not strong enough or you're weak. That adds another layer of stress to the client that they don't need. We also want to highlight that the story and the narrative is ongoing. It's developing. Remember the idea of grief bursts. It comes and goes. We're not talking about linear stages or steps. We can also assist with goal formation and reconceptualizing goals. Maybe there were plans that our client thought, ways, at this age or stage of life, I thought my life was going to be such and such. But oh my, it turned out to be this other thing. We can help them reevaluate the goals. Are they concrete? Are they specific and measurable? Can they be achieved? Are there any supports that are needed to get to those goals? So we can help them, even, again, making connection to resources in the community. Another tool that I use with many clients is a serenity prayer. The aspect of that serenity prayer that they really identify a lot with is the differentiating between what they can and can't control. So I'm going to read the brief version of the serenity prayer. God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and wisdom to know the difference. Living one day at a time, enjoying a moment at a time, accepting hardship as a pathway to peace, taking as Jesus did the sinful world as it is, not as I would have it, trusting that you will make all things right if surrendered to your will, so that I may reasonably be happy in this life and supremely happy with you in the next life. Amen. So a lot of times people don't always know the whole context of that, so that's why I included the whole serenity prayer. But for many clients, we can focus on that first part. A lot of our clients, if they've had substance use or self-medicating issues, may be well familiar with the serenity prayer. they may be familiar with the 12 steps about the surrendering my will to a higher power, about hardships being pathways to peace, about differentiating between what I can and can't control. One thing I frequently work with clients about is the idea that we can either look at feeling helpless of, oh man, look how many things on this list I cannot control. Gosh, life's just happening to me. I feel like this passive whatever, nothing's going the right way. Or we can look at, you know what? Thankfully, I can't control it. You know, it's been freeing to many of my clients when they're able to look at a few goals. Because the worst thing oftentimes they can do is trying to change too much at once. So we can help our clients look at reasonable action plans. By and large, one of the things that we just repeatedly hear as a useful technique for many issues in psychotherapy is, of course, the cognitive behavioral approach. With that, a lot of times I'll teach my clients the red flags, the type of ways in terms of self-talk that we all do that can keep us in these ruts. Things like shoulds, comments like if only then, if I do the good, right, strong, perfect things, if I'm strong enough through these changes, oh, if I was strong and intelligent enough, I should be able to handle. Things like have to's, absolute thoughts, all or nothing. So we teach these thought errors and help them identify which ones pertain to them. We teach them the idea that feelings can lie to us. We might have a strong impression or a feeling about something, but just because we feel it doesn't necessarily mean it's a truth. And most often it's not. We might not be able to directly change those feelings of depression, anxiety, stress, hopelessness, complicated grief, but we can identify some of these automatic negative thought patterns that are global about ourselves, about others, about the world around us, about the ominous thoughts of what we think might happen next since we are faced with this grief. So we'll help the client identify his or her irrational misbeliefs. We'll teach cognitive debating strategies and help them come up with renewed ways of looking at things. So that we'll help them review their thoughts. We'll help them examine how helpful or not helpful those thoughts are. And not just thoughts, but behaviors. As I referred to earlier, sometimes there's behavior errors that we make. One is trying when we're already feeling worn out and overwhelmed and juggling a lot of emotions with grief to feel like, okay, in this weak state, I have to do more. I have to try more. I just need to push myself. And then that's where shame comes in. Then I feel inadequate. I can't possibly do it. But also it feels ineffective. It sets people up for potential health problems. It really is not helpful. Or sometimes people go the behavioral route of avoidance. So we can help clients by testing and changing the thought patterns or the behavior reactions. We can help them conduct behavioral experiments to help them look at alternative thoughts and set realistic goals. You'll see in the PowerPoint that I actually have listed 12 different thinking error types. Now, I know, depending on the source, there's, you know, some people might have 10, some people might have 15 or 20, and there's variations of these. But what I think is useful for most of our clients is to be able to talk through with them or even give them a handout and help them identify which are the ones they tend to use the most. So things like awfulizing or catastrophizing. Especially when life didn't go the way I thought it would. When there's unfairness, injustice, hurt, sadness, anger. When there's resentment, when there's unforgiveness and unfinished business, it's easy to jump to the most awful conclusion of, if this thing happened, and especially if someone's still in that process of meaning-making, if this happened, then, what else could happen? You know, and something else might happen again, even if I'm good-intentioned. Some people make thinking errors of either disqualifying good, happy, or neutral events, or just jumping to the worst conclusion. We also have thinking errors of things like all or nothing. So, again, not giving themselves mercy to be humans, to have flaws, to have needs. There's times I've had to literally say, as silly as this sounds, directly to a client, I want you to know, from my point of view, in this office, and hopefully outside, I want you to know you have permission to make a mistake. And that may sound like a really silly comment to say, but many clients have reported that it's very freeing to them to hear that. So thinking error types, identifying those like awfulizing, catastrophizing, disqualifying or discounting positives, all or nothing thinking, low frustration tolerance, assuming the worst about themselves or others. Another one we see frequently is emotional reasoning. Oh, I felt this way in the past when something bad happened. My heart was racing or this. I feel it again. I know there's another thing. So we need to, as we'll get to in a minute here, teach our clients, after recognizing these thinking errors or behavior choices that aren't so helpful, how to challenge them and look at how realistic they are or are not. Anything in isolation, we could try and misjudge and say, ooh, this must mean this. I gave an example the other day to a guy that was going through some anxiety and some grief things. And it was a silly example, but it just proved the point to him that sometimes we link things as if they have a causal effect, and they don't. So I showed him, I said, if I'm tapping my pen repeatedly, and it's a sunny day, I might say, oh, I tapped my pen enough times so the sun stayed out. There was no rain today. And if there's a storm, oh, shoot, I forgot to tap my pen a few more times. Now there's a thunderstorm. Look how awful it's turning up. So sometimes we reason backwards that because I thought or did or felt something, it turned out this way. What I think is challenging for our clients is to realize that life isn't just so linear. Oftentimes it's not because they've done the good, right, strong, perfect things or they did such a bad thing. That good and bad, pleasant and unpleasant, happens to everyone. And I know that sounds like a great minimization, but those are the type of things indirectly we want our clients to work through. So the emotional reasoning. Other type of thinking errors are labeling or predicting based on limited information, mind reading, overgeneralizing, personalizing that this is just happening to them, and then shoulds. Want to go through a few cognitive debating strategies before we wrap up this next section, the second section of today's seminar. And you can transfer these, for example, from these next few PowerPoint slides and make your own handout. Again, I use a lot of handouts. I'm kind of a handout queen. That was one of the things that people encouraged me years ago when I was finishing grad school. Some of the older seasoned people in our field said, start collecting and making files from A to Z on types of resources, handouts, books. And that was one of the best pieces of advice. So I do collect things and I design my own handouts. So in terms of cognitive debating strategies, I will first of all have clients journal and keep a record for me, date and time, situations that are triggers for them, the feelings that tend to come up, and we'll look at these cognitive debating strategies. So I'll individualize it again to what they're going through. Then I'll role model the applications of this. Oh, so what you're thinking, is this an absolute fact or is it just a strong opinion? May just be those feelings again. The feelings, again, they're not right or wrong. They may be pleasant. They may be unpleasant. But sometimes they tell us a part truth. They don't always tell us the whole truth. Is there evidence for what I'm thinking? Is there any evidence the other way against it? Yeah, this might be a consideration, but are there other things to consider as well? Are there any alternative explanations that might be more reasonable? What would someone else make of this situation? How would they explain it? Because there can be a continuum of ways of perceiving this. And I think that's one of the greatest things we can offer our clients is helping them to see things on a continuum rather than just narrowly. How do I feel? Is this death or life producing? And for some people, that's literal. Some people, they may feel like, I don't want to live anymore. I can't handle being under the weight of this pressure and oppression. If it's dragging me down, if I don't feel like I want to wake up tomorrow, if I've lost motivation and hope, okay, what's an alternative? I like reminding our clients that much of what they experience as unpleasant, much of what relates to their presenting problems and concerns in terms of coming in with grief, loss, and mourning issues is unpleasant, but it's just automatic thoughts and behaviors. The idea is what we practice is often what sticks with us. So it's a matter of relearning habits. I like this next question as well in terms of cognitive debating strategies. What am I actually reacting to? I think that's a phenomenal question. Is it a feeling? Is there evidence? Is there anything I might be getting out of proportion? Is there really genuine harm that's been done? Or is it just an opinion I have or something I don't like? Is it possible that I'm overestimating the bad or the danger? Or is it possible that I'm underestimating my ability to cope? Wow. I like that question because it takes us back to a strengths-based, solution-focused approach. I have managed stresses before. Maybe I didn't have a loss like this one. Maybe I never expected or would have guessed in a million years I'd be dealing with what I'm coming to counseling for now. But I have handled something else. Am I pressuring myself? Is that really helping me? Can there be more than one solution? How important is this? Really? If I keep thinking and behaving the way I am, where will that take me? How might this, what I'm reporting, look like to an outside observer? Could there be another meaning or perception? And what's the bigger picture? A variation of this cognitive behavioral approach that I use with clients is when I tell them this saying, watch where you put your butts. Funny, you know, saying, but it helps, whether it's teenagers or adults, it helps them remember. So I say we don't want to deny our feelings, so we can admit even our unpleasant feelings, concerns, worries, irrational thoughts, or questions, but we don't want that to be our total reality. The error we oftentimes make is we'll say a positive self-statement like, yeah, I've been through stuff before, but man, this one's way worse. This just is totally awful. I never could get through this. So that person is dwelling on the sense of inadequacy, failure, how overwhelming. So that's going to keep them stuck. Or someone who only tells themselves the unpleasant feelings. So what we want to teach our clients is this formula of first admitting the feelings, the thoughts, the automatic reactions, the struggles, those different stages we talked about of their individualized grief, but then ultimately, after the word but, ending up with a positive self-statement, a strengths-based comment. So it could be like, man, I had the shock of my life when such and such happened. Never in a million years would I thought that after all I've worked so hard to do, that would happen to me. But, and then whatever would be a rational, realistic statement. But, I'm reaching out for help. But, I have a couple support systems that can help me meet my needs even in the midst of this shock. But, I've lived through my share of other stuff. Might have been different. I never thought I'd get on the other side with those things, but eventually I did. But I don't may not feel strong, but I do have a few skills that have helped me through that might help me again. So over time, we can help our clients make a list of after the word but, those positive, rational, realistic statements. And what I do is I keep those in their file, and they end up becoming their own little internal statements. And they're tailored. What's good about it is they're tailored to their specific perceptions. So it's not like I just give them a generic thing and be here. Here's some positive self-statements. Think better. No, we take their specific journaled struggles, feelings, thinking errors, wrestling between the grief, mourning, and loss. And then we tailor those individualized statements after the word but to what they need. Then I'll read those and I'll say, okay, let's read what's on the left-hand side. If we just focus on the unpleasant feelings, the automatic negative thoughts or behaviors, okay, what if we focus on this other side? And I'll be like, wow, I feel much lighter just focusing on this other part after the word but. But man, when I was focusing on that first part, that dragged me down. So I provided some different tools and resources in the second part of today's seminar. And when we come back, I'm going to give you even more tools and resources because I really want to broaden your toolbox about how do we help clients grieve with grace? How do we individualize to their process and just choose what tools may most benefit them? We'll be back soon with the third part of today's seminar, Grieving with Grace.